listening to 91 Reasons, a journey into the twisted landscape of pop culture. Keep your hands and arms inside the podcast at all times. And now, the voice, Jeff Tucker.
I gave a tour. Last Saturday, I gave a tour for the fine people at Mice Chat, and before that, I gave a tour to the people at Horror Buzz. These are theme park aficionados, and we gave them, me and Gus Kruger and Daniel Miller, we gave them a backstage tour with the lights on of a maze. And afterwards, we a few of us spoke and talked and took questions. And it was interesting because I was talking about how much I have always loved Halloween, that it's always been my favorite holiday. And that when I was a kid, Halloween wasn't this big, gigantic event that it is. Growing up, Halloween was one day a year, one single day. And not only that, but Halloween was 4:45 p.m. to about 8:45 p.m. So it was only about 4 hours. You know, that was all you got to go trick-or-treating before it got too dark and people turned their porch lights off and went back to watching TV or parties or whatever. And so much work went into costumes and planning the night that it seems crazy. That, and think about how many you got. So if you think about how old you are and when you really start to remember things. And I know I'm abnormal. So we'll take a normal person. A normal person might remember age 10 or 11. And just for the benefit of the doubt, we'll go to we'll take it to 10. So at 10 years old, that's the first Halloween you remember, you know. You got to pick out your costume. And, you know, for me, it was, we went to Save-On's and we looked, and then we inevitably end up making my own costume because the Luke Skywalker costume that came from Save-On was a plastic poncho jumpsuit with Luke Skywalker on the front, his picture, and then a mask that kind of looked like Mark Hamill. And I didn't want to dress up as Mark Hamill. I wanted to dress up as Luke Skywalker. So I used to make my own with a cape and a cloak and a lightsaber made out of a paper towel tube so I could hang it on my belt just the way Luke did. Because, you know, his lightsaber was rarely lit in the movie. So, 10 years old, and then when are you too old to go trick-or-treating? 15? 16? I was short. Still am. So I could get away with trick-or-treating a lot longer than most kids. But most kids, by, I want to say 15. By 15, you're too tall, you've got facial hair, you go from trick-or-treat to trick-or-treat. And that's where the people at the door go, you know, you're a little too old to be trick-or-treating. That's really for children. So you get the benefit of trick-or-treating from, when do your parents first take you? 4 or 5, you know, to like a few houses or the mall. But the concentrated trick-or-treating, the concentrated Halloween for everybody's youth is age 10 to age 15. You get 5 solid years. I'm trying to do this math right. And at 4 hours a night, Halloween is a grand total of your childhood, 20 hours. That's unbelievable. And yet that's where all the memories are made. Picking the right costume. You know, going with friends in a group costume. You know, we're all going to be the Ghostbusters. We're all going to be Jedi Knights. You know, we're all going to be monsters. Whatever it is. So I had that revelation talking to those groups. And it's very sobering, you know, when you really do the math on your life. And how, because you don't get the first decade. And even bleeding into, you know, the second decade, your brain just jettisons them in favor of what you're doing now. And that's such a bummer, you know, if we could access all of our brains, you know, and be able to recall all that. Imagine the rich memories we'd have instead of like, well, I think I remember last week, you know. And again, I know I'm completely abnormal, completely abnormal. I fully admit that. I'm short and abnormal. I get it. So we're going to continue what we started last week, as you can tell by the title of this episode, with the movies of Pixar. Last week, we covered the first few up until the first sequel, Toy Story 2, and then Monsters, Inc., which was a whole new direction for them. But still playing in that world of these objects and creatures and animals are different from humans, but the world that they live in is the same. You know, Monsters, Inc. is just Monsteropolis is just like Metropolis, except everything has a monster pun on it, right? And I talked about the dirty thing Shrek did trying to pull box office. So it didn't matter. Monsters, Inc. was a huge monster hit. So they took 2 years off, and in 2003, we got Finding Nemo. I didn't have high hopes for this film. I remember seeing the trailer and being a little underwhelmed. They're fish. It's going to be all about the dialogue with these characters because they can't do much except swim around. but it did have something going for it in that I'm a big fan of Albert Brooks, and he's the main character of the film. He's Marlin. So I knew we were going to take the kids to see it, just, you know, because it's a Pixar film. At this point, they're still the gold standard of animation. And more importantly, they're the gold standard of storytelling. You know, it doesn't matter, again, the medium you tell it in, as long as you tell a good story. And I'm very happy to report that I think Finding Nemo is a masterpiece of storytelling. It is everything a movie should be. It is at times sad, thrilling, very, very funny, exciting, and wraps up everything very nicely. It's a very complete story. It uses all of its elements that it introduces. It introduces you to a world under the water, and then plays by the rules of under the sea. When we get to Finding Dory, I'll have a lot to say about breaking those rules. And that's where, spoiler alert, that movie completely falls apart. But Finding Nemo is a masterpiece. It's got Albert Brooks. It's got Willem Dafoe. All of the Tank Gang, everybody in there is a great character actor. It has Jeffrey Rush as the Pelican. And then it has the biggest surprise for me, Ellen DeGeneres as Dory. Now, I've never been an Ellen DeGeneres fan. I've never thought she was funny. Her brand of humor was not directed at me. I've never gotten it. I was on Hollywood Squares. She was the center square. And all of us contestants wanted to physically hurt her because her brand of comedy involves a lot of stuttering and then asking to hear the question again. And every time you ask on Hollywood Squares to hear the question again, you've eliminated a whole turn for one of the characters, for one of the players. You know, if you're an X or an O, you've eliminated the time-wise. The host doesn't have time to read another question because he's reading the same question twice. And that really drove us all batty because she would do it every turn and everybody always goes for the center square first. So I wasn't... Now, I went on Hollywood Squares after Nemo, to be fair. But I wasn't a fan of hers at all. And yet, she is maybe... I mean, not maybe. She's the best thing about the movie. You know, Albert Brooks is doing Albert Brooks. But the character of Dory is written so well and so funny and so honest that it's really hard not to walk away from that film loving her character. You know, and I said it was a miracle. 2003 was a miracle because I said, as an adult, if you'd have told me that the two best movies of the summer of the year would be a talking fish movie and a movie based off of a theme park attraction, I'm talking about Pirates of the Caribbean, that those would be the two best movies of the year from the Walt Disney Company, I would have been shocked. Walt Disney Company makes great movies, but they're always outdone by a sci-fi movie or an action movie or something else. But teaming up the double whammy of Pixar doing Finding Nemo and Jerry Bruckheimer doing Pirates of the Caribbean, that's a recipe for huge success, both in box office and in storytelling. Both of those films have intricate, fun stories. And part of the fun of Finding Nemo is Nemo disappearing, being caught by the net, and Marlin just at that moment taking off. There's no planning. He doesn't go pack a bag or what should I do. He just takes off after him, like any good father would. And I do love, there's a great sequence in The Simpsons where Milhouse does not know there's a chapter one on the Finding Nemo DVD, and Bart finally shows Nemo's mother dying. It's very, very traumatic. And it was very traumatic in the theater. But what it does is it sets up Marlin's character so well that he's lost, you know, 100 children to this monster, this predator, and his wife. And you see why he's so darn protective of Nemo. And Nemo's not only his only child, but Nemo has a small fin, so he's disabled. So Marlin's caretaking is even more amped up. He is more aware. Now, I know that in the real world, clownfish, in the absence of a mate, will change genders. Now, they didn't do that in the film. They didn't have Marlin turn into a woman in the film. But in today's social justice warrior culture, I don't put it past them in the third film, because you know there'll be a third one. The first two have made buckets and buckets of money. Finding Nemo, I think, was for a long time the most successful animated film of all time. Of course, they eclipse it every couple years. A new one comes out and makes more and more money. But Nemo was amazing. And here's the thing about Finding Nemo that you'll find shocking. Not a lot of toys. Monsters, Inc. had a huge, massive push for merchandise. Nemo, not so much. I mean, how do you sell fish toys to kids? They did PVCs and t-shirts and bedding and stuff, but not the onslaught of toys you normally get in an animated film, because the characters just don't lend themselves to that. Now, they did make a series of really well-done pieces from the Disney store, and I know this because I actually ran across one of the anglerfish, the fish that has the light that mesmerizes Dory, that they find deep in the ocean. They actually made a toy. It's a terrifying toy with big, clear, giant teeth and that light that lights up on the front. And I actually said Disney Pixar. I'd never seen it before. Never seen one since. And I actually sold that one for a lot of money. And after I sold it, I got a lot of emails from people saying, my kid needs this for his collection. Where'd you get it? And I'm like, I got it at the swap meet, man. And I wouldn't know where to get any more. I wish I had a dozen of them. Are you kidding? But no, what a great movie. It's fun. My favorite part of Finding Nemo, and there are a lot of parts that you could call your favorite. There's, you know, the fish that make shapes. You know, it's done by John Ratzenberger. Look at this guy. Or, you know, the turtles are great, you know. Yeah, Sarius Threlish is the dude. But my favorite part is just character interaction. And it's where Nigel the Pelican lands in the window of the dentist office. And he's letting Nemo know that his dad is coming for him. And he goes through the tale of everything that Marlin has done to get to Nemo. And they just cut to Nemo's face, and he's listening to this unbelievable feat that his father has done for him. And to me, that scene just always gives me chills, because it's so well written. It's a son realizing that his father is there for him. What's also great about that film is as Marlin is racing to find Nemo, Nemo is trying to get out himself. So we have the two adventures going on at the same time. It would have been very easy just to stick Nemo in a tank and have Marlin rescue him somehow at the end. But having the tank gang accept Nemo as one of their own, you know, Mount Wanahakalugi, shark bait, rounds out the film and gives Nemo the character growth he needs, the same as Marlin, you know. And to think it all, the story all starts because Nemo touches a butt. It's a great film. It's a really great film. It holds up today. It's a beautiful film. Finding Nemo.
Stop! I got something to tell ya! Mike?
Don't make any sudden moves. Hop inside my mouth if you want to live.
Hey, all right, right, all right.
Hold on, wait to cross.
71% of the Earth's surface is covered by water.
How's it going, Bob?
That's a big place to find one fish.
Has anybody seen my son?
Your son Chico?
No, it's Nemo. We're looking for Nemo. Name's Crush.
I gotta find my son Nemo.
Grab Shell, dude.
To find Nemo.
Let's ask for directions.
No!
What is it with men and asking for directions?
We'll take a miracle.
Yeah, I saw him, but I'm not telling you where he went.
All right, I'll talk!
Getting him back is a whole other story. Walt Disney Pictures presents a Pixar Animation Studios film.
We're gonna help him escape.
Nemo, don't give up!
Your dad's been fighting the entire ocean looking for you.
I'm coming, Nemo!
No. I never knew my father!
Come on, good night.
Oh, my stomach.
No hurling on the shell, dude, okay? Just waxed it.
You've got to see it. To believe it.
Nice.
Finding Nemo.
Everybody hold on!
I think The Incredibles is unbelievable. It is amazingly done. This is their 2004 release. Brad Bird did everything on it. It's the first Pixar movie to star people. They're stylized, heavily stylized, but it doesn't matter. The voice work is astoundingly good. The story is good, even though it does echo the Fantastic Four meets the Watchmen. There's just something about The Incredibles that is so well done. What I used to say to anyone who asked me about it was, the thing that The Incredibles does that astounds you is, after about 2 or 3 minutes in, you actually can forget that you're watching an animated movie. The characters come across so darn real that they defy their animated roots. Mr. Incredible, when he goes, you know, what do you mean there's another crime? I just cleaned up in here. And everybody goes, whoa, and the camera moves. Like, it's so unlike any other animated movie in that it treats the characters so darn real. The characters argue. They're a family. They're in hiding and they're trying to suppress that each one of them has these amazing superpowers. They have left overnight and they argue about it. And Dash is a young kid who cannot wait to use his powers. Bob Parr is stuck in a job he doesn't want to do, but he does it for his family because this is how you get by in a world that has outlawed superheroes. He tries to help people. The woman who comes in, he's trying to tell her which paper to file to get the benefits that she wants. You know, his car is too small. They set Bob up so well. And they set Mrs. Helen Parr, you know, Elastigirl up so well, too. I've always been a big Holly Hunter fan. This is one of her greatest creations. And it's not her other than her voice. But it comes across so real. This is a movie about, you know, on the surface, it's about superheroes. It's about hero worship. And it's about how does a world deal with people who are physically stronger than them. And how they suppress it because they're terrified of it instead of embracing it. But deeper than that, it's about a guy having a midlife crisis. Bob Parr is having a midlife crisis. You know, it's never said in the film, but he's got to be impotent. He's completely overweight. He doesn't fit in his super suit anymore. And he spends his time looking at magazine covers of when he used to be relevant, both as a superhero, as a man, husband, and father. And when the secret organization comes a-calling to hire him to test out this island's defense mechanisms as a superhero, he finds within him that he was great all along, that he didn't need anything else to be great. And, you know, if that doesn't resonate with the men who watch this movie, then you're brain dead, you know, because it's so stellar to watch Bob go from, you know, he's not in a cubicle, but he's in a tiny office, to drinking a mimosa and letting his, you know, his masculinity run free, which he's not allowed to. His masculinity, i.e. his superpowers, are suppressed. It's a society that's trying to push him down. And he illegally finds a way to break free. You know, when him and Frozone go out on that middle of the night, you know, journey, they're just getting a hit. You know what I mean? They go around and they get a little hit of how it used to be. They get a contact high doing good, because not only are they not allowed to do good as superheroes, but they're not allowed to do good as humans. Bob is told to ruin people's lives financially because of the insurance. You know, Frozone is, it's implied, and you see it later in the film, Frozone is completely henpecked by his wife, who should be exalting him for the amazing superhero that he is. And instead, she's jealous that he's going out and doing things. So these are two men that have been suppressed. And the same thing happens to Elastigirl. You know, she is suppressed too by a society that doesn't want a strong female. And yet, Elastigirl has some of the most strong moments of the movie. You know, when Syndrome reveals himself to Mr. Incredible and is then captured, there's that moment where you think you're dealing with a run-of-the-mill movie villain. You know, he's going to tell you what he's going to do. When everybody's super, then nobody's super. It's a crazy plan. He'll never succeed. And then when Helen shows up with her kids in a plane, Syndrome just orders it destroyed. There's no find out who it is. No, blow it out of the sky. And it's up to Helen to save the kids. And that's a fantastic sequence. When they're falling out of the sky and they realize, you know, S just got real, that this is not a game. Being a superhero is not a game. You can die in this world. They show many superheroes dying in this. Bob comes across a cave full of superhero remnants. So it's very deadly serious. The guards on the island are shooting at Dash with real bullets. They're shooting at Violet with real bullets. And when Syndrome orders that missile to fire and the plane blows up, Bob, Mr. Incredible, is convinced his wife and kids just died. That's why this movie's so good, because it doesn't sugarcoat what it's like to be a superhero. It shows you how tight this family is and how much they care for each other. And when Bob, I keep on Bob, when Mr. Incredible tries to kill, I think her name is Sapphire, the Syndrome's assistant, played by, I think, Marita Conchita Alonso, who passed away, but he's going to kill her because he has nothing to live for anyways. His wife and kids are dead. And she's like, no. They're alive on the island. And that's such a fantastic moment. I want to play this moment just because I really love it. So check this out.
There isn't much time.
No, there isn't. In fact, there's no time at all.
Please.
Why are you here? How can you possibly bring me lower? What more can you take away from me?
A family survived the crash. They're here on the island.
They're alive? Helen?
Hello. You must be Mrs. Sinclair.
She was helping me to escape.
No, that's what I was doing. Let go of me. Let go, you lousy, lying, unfaithful creep.
How could I betray the perfect woman?
Oh, you're referring to me now?
Where are the kids?
They might have triggered the alert.
What?
Security's been sent into the jungle. You'd better get going.
Now our kids are in danger?
If you suspected danger, why'd you bring them?
I didn't bring them. They stowed away, and I don't think you're striking them.
That's my favorite moment of the film. It's where it looks as if they're going to have this big, stupid argument because she thinks he's been cheating on her, and he just shuts it down. He basically says, you're the only reason I'm alive, and I am not going to let you start a fight. We have to save our kids, and that's all that matters. And I love that she just goes with it because she realizes, without a fight, that they love each other more than anything. That's why this movie is so good. You know, would you love to see that scene between Reed Richards and Sue Richards? Like, you just, if you could gloss over in your mind and paint different superheroes, you don't get those scenes in those movies. They're too busy knocking buildings down to care about the emotions between the characters. You know, they're too busy figuring out what looks best in 3D. And instead, what they should be doing is writing scenes like that, you know, or the scene where Elastigirl is caught in the train cars. I love that sequence where she takes a moment, even after this amazing sequence, to see how she looks in her suit after all these years. You know, those are such human, real, fun moments. You know, the exhilaration that Dash feels when he's running on water, when he looks down and is like, not only am I running fast and letting my powers run free, but I'm defying gravity. And who doesn't run with Dash as he's doing that and dream of doing that? That's what superheroes movies are supposed to. Supposed to be uplifting like that. I don't mind a dark one like Watchmen. I really don't. But this is supposed to be, quote-unquote, a kid's movie, but it's more of a family movie. This is a movie you watch with your family and realize how important these people are that you're with. Man, it's such a good movie. You know, Brad Bird had done The Iron Giant, which is another fantastic movie. I'll get around to reviewing that one at some point. But his movie, The Incredibles, the first time I think an outsider had been brought in to Pixar to direct a film, they wisely went with a veteran who had done extensive work on The Simpsons. He did the show Family Dog, which was originally an Amazing Stories episode. And they hit it out of the park with this one. The score is good. The trailers are good. The trailers are good because they're not scenes from the movie. They're original scenes that give you flavor of the movie. They didn't release a full trailer until the movie was ready to be released. But the teaser one, those are just flavors of the movie. Fantastic. Still holds up. Still holds up as my favorite Pixar movie. Okay, now we're going to move into, oh boy, Cars. Let's talk about Cars. There's no denying that Pixar is a stable of geniuses. These guys work hard. They're not satisfied until the movies are perfect. I get that. The visuals are stunning. They consistently are able to show you, the audience, we, the audience, something we have never seen before. And that's a darn rare thing in the movies. And to do it again and again and again is astounding. But I think Cars is where they got a little lost. They fell in love with Route 66, the Mother Road. And they wanted to tell a story of what happens when the freeway comes to town. And instead, now they did tell that story. And there are moments in Cars that are amazing. But on the whole, the film to me, now I'm a parent. By 2006, this movie came out, I have three children. Cars to me seems like nothing but a commercial for toys. Lightning McQueen is a goofy pitch man for a lifestyle brand of merchandise for children. Hot Wheel size, bigger size, ride-on size, breakfast cereal, bed sheets, toothpaste, wall hangings. They even had a Lightning McQueen television DVD combo with his eyes on it. They made everything for Cars. This is, I think, other than Star Wars, the biggest merchandise launch of a singular product in the history of mankind. You couldn't go anywhere without being bombarded by Cars merchandise. They were at McDonald's. They were down every aisle of Target and Walmart. They even bizarrely tried to sell Halloween costumes that year of, like, you were Lightning McQueen's repairman. Now, they did sell these stupid things you could put over your kid, like, you know, like those horse things that have suspenders where it looks like you're riding a horse. It looked like you were being, you know, being devoured by a car. They made those, but they also made the Rusties and Radiator Springs, like, human costumes, which are, again, bizarre because there's none of that in the film. But I guess, you know, you got to have Halloween costumes, and how do you turn a kid into a car? I don't know, unless you're watching Turbo Teen. But the problem I have with Cars, it looks amazing. Those shots of Radiator Springs, especially with the neon, you know, when they turn the neon back on and have that night in town, it's, oh my God, it's gorgeous. Wow. The James Taylor music moment is at Little Town. Amazing. You know, and I'm saying that amazing stuff up front because when I start trashing it, it's to take the sting out of it. If you like this movie, God bless you. Having lived through a child who wanted every single piece of merchandise, I've had enough of Lightning McQueen, ka-chow, to last me a lifetime. The only thing I liked about Cars was Michael Keaton as Chick Hicks. Right? But the main problem with Cars is they ripped off the story. And they didn't just rip it off like it's kind of similar. It's exactly beat for beat Doc Hollywood. If you've ever seen, now I've seen Doc Hollywood. It stars Michael J. Fox, so of course I've seen it. Doc Hollywood's the movie that he found out he had Parkinson's on. Doc Hollywood is about a hotshot doctor who's going to become a professional by going to Los Angeles and becoming a plastic surgeon. But before he gets there, he drives his sports car down Route 66. He takes a detour to a small town where he inadvertently destroys part of a fence in the town. And so the local judge sentences him to community service to pay for it. And there's even a love interest, and I swear even a country bumpkin who wants to be his best friend, played by Woody Harrelson. So every single beat of this movie is there. Instead of A Night in the Town, they have the Squash Festival. Instead of Mater, it's Woody Harrelson. He even leaves the small town, goes to the big town to become a plastic surgeon, and realizes it's not for him, and comes back. I mean, it is beat for beat the same exact movie. And I can't figure out why, during the process of making Cars, nobody sat down and said, hey, it looks amazing. We've got all these great vocal actors. Paul Newman, right? Amazing. But I want you to watch Doc Hollywood because I think there may be a problem. Or maybe they just figured, who cares? Or, now I'm diving deep into the darkness here. Doc Hollywood is put out by Hollywood Pictures, a subsidiary of the Walt Disney Company. So maybe it doesn't matter because no one's going to get in trouble anyways. And I get it if you want to crib here and there. My books are homages all the way through. I crib from everybody. That's part of the fun. But Doc Hollywood, they didn't crib from. They just lifted the entire plot. Beat for beat. I experienced a lot through Cars with my kids. We went down to the El Capitan. We saw the full-size Lightning McQueen they built for the film. We watched all the making of. Austin collected so many of these toys. The rare Mater with his hood on. The Sarge that was made of lead paint that if you put it in your mouth would make you see stars and rainbows. Having to buy the cars again because they kept putting out... they turned Lightning McQueen into the Batman of the line in that I think there must be 50 different variations of him. They even had one that was like Lightning McQueen with bits of cactus on him. Lightning McQueen with muddy tires. Lightning McQueen shiny. Lightning McQueen wrecked. Lightning McQueen blah, 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 blah. Lightning McQueen, right? The rare Model T guy. The rare Floyd, which was played by the amazing George Carlin. The voice acting in this was fantastic. And I've been to Cars Land at California Adventure. I've been on the ride. And when you go to Cars Land, which is Radiator Springs, it's astounding. And the first time I went there, I said, this is amazing. Imagine if I actually cared about the property. I guess that'll be Galaxy's Edge next summer, the Star Wars land they're building at Disneyland. The ride, Radiator Springs Racers, is amazing. If I was a kid and I liked this franchise, that ride would be a religious experience because you are in Radiator Springs. The cars are there. They're life-size. They talk. They blink. It is amazing what they've done with this property. It's unbelievable what they did with the Cars property. Maybe if the story hadn't been so darn derivative of Doc Hollywood, I would give it higher points. But to me, Cars is the first time Pixar slipped. Now, box office doesn't say that. I'm talking about my point of view as a storyteller, as a parent. This was a movie that slipped. It wasn't for me. We saw it a couple times in the theater because of Austin. He was very into it. He was very into NASCAR for a short time. But if I never saw it again, I'd be fine. And I've not, spoiler alert, I've not seen 2 or 3. I just don't care. And when we get to that, they'll be quick. I don't care about these movies. because they just don't care about the franchise. You know, it has its moments. Like I said, it has some beautiful shots. I like the moment where Lightning McQueen is like, is that a little tattoo on your bumper? And she's got like a tramp stamp. I mean, that's pretty funny for the adults. That's great. Paul Newman's great in it. I'm not so much a fan of Larry the Cable Guy, the Get Her Done guy. You know, I do like the line where they start talking about the Piston Cup. And he goes, he did what in his cup? I mean, that's funny. I there's some moments, but you know, even a broken clock is right twice a day. And even a terrible movie can have its moments. Phantom Menace has the pod race scene, but doesn't make it a good movie. And Cars, again, I'll be the first to say, I get it wasn't made for me. It's made for little kids. I drive around all day. Driving a car is not exciting to me. Driving freeways is not fun. I could care less. But when you're a kid and you have Hot Wheels, and Pixar figured a way to reinvent Hot Wheels by putting a face on it, changing toys forever. Now we have Han Solo as a Hot Wheel, Chewbacca as a Hot Wheel. They even made Buzz and Woody as cars in the Cars universe. I mean, talk about craziness. Cars, man. Okay, we're going to finish up with this episode. This is a movie I thought, the next one in their release schedule, Ratatouille. And I remember seeing the trailer and thinking, this is going to be Pixar's first bomb. They've made a movie about rats that want to be French chefs. And it looks like a horrible, horrible mistake. They fired the original director. They brought Brad Bird in to fix it any way he could. And I took my kids to see Ratatouille at the AMC Fullerton on the classic side. And when we got there, there was no air conditioning. It was about 85 degrees in the theater. And we sat there for a while. And when the movie started, I said, if you guys want to go, you let me know, because it's too hot in here. And I tell you what, Ratatouille was so good that we endured an 85 degree movie theater to watch it. They gave us tickets to come back, so we did see it again in an air conditioned theater. But Ratatouille is so good that it defied heat. I mean, that's amazing, right? I don't know what it looked like originally, but what Brad Bird was able to do with the pieces that he had, I wouldn't say Ratatouille is a masterpiece. It does have its weirdness. You have to buy the rat pulling the guy's hair, Remy pulling his hair to make his arms move, which makes no sense. But if you can buy off on that, then you can buy off on the rest of the story, that a rat wants to be a cook. A dirty, filthy, disease-laden rat. My wife loves rats, but what are you going to do? These are different. These are street rats. Not Aladdin, but street rats. And if you can get past the hair-pulling thing, you can buy into the movie that anyone can cook. And it is one of the best examples of somebody dreaming above their pay rate. You know, a rat's never going to be a cook, ever, according to society. And yet, Remy's going to defy that. And he's going to find a way. And the most amazing thing that Ratatouille does, it has two things that I think are masterpiece. And it's got to be Brad Bird. The first is, the movie does a visual representation of what flavor is. When Remy is describing to his brother, don't just hork it down. Savor it. And you see the fireworks of this flavor combined with this flavor makes a different kind of firework. It's an amazing way, visually, to describe to the audience that Remy has taste buds. It's phenomenal. And it's done so effortlessly that most people don't even notice it. Well, yeah, that's cool. No. Describe what chocolate tastes like to somebody. Right? It's hard to do. And yet in Ratatouille, It's done effortlessly. It's really amazing. The other thing that it does is it tells you why characters are the way they are and why they make the choices that they do. The food critic, played by Peter O'Toole, the great Peter O'Toole, who's in the film, his office is a coffin, his typewriter is a skull. Gustav Graves? No, that's somebody else. Is that his name? I don't remember. But when they finally are going to serve the food critic his food, Remy decides to make the title dish ratatouille because it contains the word rat. I get it. But how are we going to let the audience know that the food critic approves of this dish? He can't just go, oh, it's delicious. Good job. That's anticlimactic. And instead, we go into his brain. We see him as a beat down child, bullied, menaced by people. And the only thing that brought him comfort was coming home and his mother making him ratatouille. I mean, that is brilliant. And then when he's suddenly full of life and color because somebody has finally broken through his shell of what's made him such a horrible person, and the love that we have for our mother and the comfort that we have of, her embrace and doing it through food, because the movie's theme is food, that's masterful storytelling. That's what every writer, if you get moments like that in your script, you've done it. You only need one or two. And they go by so quick that the audience goes, oh, he likes it because his mom made it. He likes it because it's the only thing that's ever brought him joy. It's more than just he likes it. Anybody likes it. It's what it means symbolically. And that's so good. That's storytelling. I know that in Disneyland Paris, they had a restaurant where you could meet Remy. They would bring him around on a rolling cart. He couldn't speak because rats don't speak, but he could squeak at you. And it was you can see videos of it on YouTube. It's pretty amazing. And they also had a ride, which was in Disneyland Paris, which is a combination of physical sets and 3D screens. And that's amazing. Check that out on YouTube. I love Ratatouille. I've not seen it in a long time. It still holds up. It's another movie where they're pushing what human characters look like in a Pixar movie. You totally buy these characters. They are secondary to the rat characters, right? But that's okay, because the movie's about the rats. But the humans are there too. Hey there, little guy, little chef. It's a great film. I love the danger of it. I love the chutzpah of rats dreaming to be cooks and actually succeeding. And the movie not being silly. It never comes across as silly. It comes across as dream bigger. Dream bigger than who you are. And what better message could we have for a movie than that? All right, we're going to end it there. My voice is fading, as you can tell. Halloween Haunt, Not Scary Farm, continues to kick my butt. I had really long days over the weekend. Great time working it. Not complaining at all. Love what I do. It's fantastic. Come see us. Come out to Not Scary Farm and see us. So thanks for tuning in. There's a lot coming up on the show. We did do a show with Rachel and Austin that got lost because of a technical issue, which really sucks. Rachel's first taste of that, and that was a real bummer. So we're getting better at audio, though. The other big news is, in the next couple of weeks, if you don't see an episode automatically in your queue, you might be unsubscribed. And I say that because I'm going to move the show from Podomatic to another service provider that's going to allow me to have all of my back catalog available at all times. My amazing friend and audio genius, Zach, is going to help me do that. So in the next couple weeks, if you don't see that in your feed, a new episode, it's not because I'm not doing it. It could be because you got unsubscribed. So you may have to subscribe again. And I thank you for doing that. Thanks to all my amazing Patreon pledgers. You guys are fantastic. I couldn't do the show without you. You saved my life every month. You have no idea. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Every dollar counts. It goes right to the show. It's not a lot of money, but that's okay because it's enough that I can push through and buy equipment if I need to, or like we're doing this, help to move it over to the new server so that we can have all the episodes available. We'll be back with a part three of Pixar movies, starting with WALL-E. And what could I possibly say about WALL-E? I don't know, but it was another one of Austin's manias. So I'll see you on the next episode of 91 Reasons.
Thanks for listening to 91 Reasons. Please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. Find us on Facebook. Is anyone even still listening?
Woman, we are talking about the greater good!
Right.